Cloudy day today, seasonal temperatures, and a high of 80 degrees. But don't forget, a 60% chance of rain. Tonight, cloudy and mild, 50-50 chance of rain, a low of 62. The lovely weather comes back tomorrow, partly sunny, 75 for Friday. Right now, humidity is at 80%, wind from the south-southwest at 8, 65 degrees at 8:10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I could not be more pleased to be welcoming to our program today the new president of Carthage College, the 23rd president of Carthage College in its 170-year history, Dr. John Swallow. And Dr. Swallow took over the reins of leadership of Carthage from his predecessor, Dr. Gregory Campbell, I believe on the 1st of July. And so Dr. Swallow has been already making the rounds, and this is, of course, his very first appearance on the Morning Show, the first of many, I trust, over the ensuing years. And I have to say that without exception, every single person who has met Dr. Swallow, heard him speak, has spoken in only the highest terms of praise. So I'm especially excited for this opportunity to finally meet my boss at Carthage and to find out a bit more about his background and to introduce him to all of you. Dr. John Swallow, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
And I just wonder, at this stage of the game and 5 weeks into this term, what this feels like. Does this still feel like kind of a bewildering whirlwind, or is Carthage and Kenosha Racine starting to feel like home?
Oh, definitely starting to feel like home. It's true, the first few weeks can be a whirlwind, and I want to thank all my colleagues on the transition team for setting up lots of meetings with faculty and staff and community leaders. But I've gotten to know Kenosha a bit, and now I'm in Racine for a while, and the people are warm and friendly, very Midwestern, and I'm just thrilled to be here. The first month, I think, went all right, and the second month, now I'm digging in a bit more, learning a few more details here and there. It's just been a joy.
Before we hear about your whole life right from the start, I think it would be really interesting to know a little bit about the circumstances under which you felt drawn to Carthage in terms of applying for this position as it came open. At the time, you were at the University of the South, known as Sewanee, and your alma mater, I believe.
That's right.
So obviously it would be a place you loved on a whole lot of different levels. Did anything in particular leave you open to this opportunity that presented itself in Carthage?
Sure. Well, first I'll say that I've spent my whole career at liberal arts colleges, and so I'm just an absolute liberal arts college patriot. And yes, I was having a great time. I would say learning the ropes in administration at Suwannee under a great president, John McArdle. And my wife Cameron and I had thought that we would move to Suwannee and our children, Ruth and Sophie, would complete high school and go on to college. So we were certainly planning to be there for some time. And then there's something about the spirit of adventure. So Ruth went off to Carleton, Sophie went off to Middlebury, and Cameron and I realized that there could be a very large and new, exciting chapter in our lives. Mm. And so that's when we sort of caught the bug. And I applied only to liberal arts colleges and was delighted to see the Carthage opportunity as one which is an institution that's had a lot of momentum and development over the years and has not seemed afraid to try some new things. And so that was particularly attractive. Also, I have some relatives in the Chicago area. The home base for my family had been Chicago. My family a couple generations back were immigrants to Chicago. And so there was kind of a feeling of home, even though I'd only spent a few summers near Chicago. But so that was attractive as well.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of the mechanism by which these sorts of openings are kind of broadcast to potential applicants? I mean,
oh, sure.
I suspect you're not reading the want ads to find out that there's a presidential opening at Carthage.
No. There's an entire cottage industry around this. As soon as I came to Suwannee in an administrative position, it wasn't before a couple of days when search consultants start asking you if you want to go to another position. Mm. And, of course, it's easy at the beginning. It's like, of course not. I'm just starting. but, of course, they have lots of interest. They want not only to attract you, perhaps, but they also want to become known because they would like to help you with other searches for vice presidents and so on. And so over time, particularly if you've been involved in searches, you get to know some of the search consultants and their strengths and weaknesses, what they seem particularly interested in. So I would get those emails regularly, and it was only this last year that I seriously responded to any of them. And so then you enter a process, which is often very confidential, for better or for worse. There are pluses and minuses to that, but you talk to the search consultant, try to get a sense of the place beyond the position description, talk about a letter and a CV you would send and what's particularly relevant to the people on the campus, and then just sort of take it from there.
Someone I know who was part of the search committee described something in this process, which I hadn't heard of before, the airport interview.
Oh, yes.
it sounds intriguing and maybe more interesting than it actually is, but explain to our listeners what the airport interview is.
Yes, the airport interview. So this has become quite common, not only for presidential searches, but for a number of searches. You may have applicants coming from across the country for a position, and you may have people on the committee, not only locally, but let's say trustees who are coming from different places. And so where to meet? Well, if you're trying to keep this somewhat confidential, having it right in the middle of campus is probably not the best idea. And so it's convenient for transportation to choose an airport that has good connections. And then it's a nondescript conference room in some hotel near this airport. And so everyone flies in. This can be interesting. There's an elaborate protocol where candidates are told to stay in their rooms so that they won't meet, even potentially, another candidate or even notice that they're there, and you're escorted from one place to another. That can be a little overdone. But otherwise, it's all the same. You meet in a room for 45 minutes to an hour. The committee tends to have developed a set of questions to try to treat every candidate equally. And it is meant to be a conversation, but of course, the candidate is asked to respond to lots of questions, and then you try to accomplish a lot in what is frankly only an hour. Mm. And so that is its own thing.
Right. Well, and in a very generic space.
Yes, absolutely.
And I should think that works against you in terms of getting a feel for the place, but at least you get at least something of a feel of the people.
Right. The connection with the people is very important, and there's not much you can do over an hour. And frankly, I'd say that the larger the search committee, the harder it is to have a relational interaction. It just seems like you're answering survey questions. But I would say the Carthage interview team was smaller. And so that was, I think, helpful. We had a better conversation than in some situations. And so I did get a little bit more of a sense. Of course, you don't really get a sense, though, until you come to campus and experience the place.
Right. So at what point were you actually offered this position?
So it would have been April or May. I'm forgetting the exact timeline, but there's sort of an elaborate dance. You understand that there may be some candidates coming for a campus interview, not only you. And then afterwards, the search committee will have a conversation. And then, of course, the board will need to vote. And until the board votes, then nothing is truly official. And so all that happened pretty rapidly, late April, early May. And so Cameron and I prepared to make a move pretty quickly. Mm. And so it's kind of remarkable that it was only May, and then here we are in August.
Right. And this is maybe a too personal a question to ask, but I am curious that once you were offered this position, was it just a foregone conclusion that you would say yes? I mean, would we assume that you would not have even entered into this process or followed it through without being fully open to accepting such an offer? Or were there things you still had to think about in order to actually accept the offer to come and be president?
Well, by the time we got to that point, it was, for me, a foregone conclusion. I knew enough to know that this would be a very exciting, thrilling position, a great opportunity for Cameron and me both. You know, that's not so true at the beginning of a search because you don't know the school, and the school, frankly, doesn't know you. Some people describe this as sort of, you know, early dating. You're not sure you would want to commit, but then the more you know, then at a certain point you say, this really could be a really great match, and I hope it's mutual.
Mm. Well, I assure you it is. And again, I happen to be able to speak to a couple of different people who were part of the search process and who essentially conveyed that it was a slam dunk. So it's not like it was a difficult decision for them to make. And I'm glad to hear that you've had such good feelings about Carthage all along the way. And so the position was offered, you accepted it, and then when did you actually move to town?
I drove up from Tennessee with a few things in my Honda Civic on July 1st. I felt it was important to be present on the first day, even though it was a Saturday. And I felt it was important. It wasn't only because of the transitional arrangement with the president's house, but to be on campus and being in the residence hall for July was certainly a short commute, but also it allowed me to get to know faculty, staff, even some students particularly well. So it felt like being a graduate student again, being in the residence hall. So yes, July 1st was the day that I came up, and then my wife has joined me this past weekend.
And my understanding is you are living in a home in Racine right now while the president's home on campus is being refurbished.
That's right.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. John Swallow, who is the new president of Carthage College. I was going to tell you this off the air. I might as well say it right into the mic. The first couple times I was typing out the schedule for this week, for some reason, I kept typing Dr. John Shallow with an H instead of a W.
You won't have been the first.
Yes, but I think that would have not been good form on my part to call you Dr. Shallow, and I'm glad that thus far I've remembered to call you Dr. Swallow. And
well, I'll try not to be too shallow. I can also tell you that if I leave my name at a restaurant, often it comes back Sparrow, Party of Four.
Oh.
So I don't know what's going on with that either.
Well, Swallow is a lovely name. And that's a nice segue into our next question, which is to find out a bit more about where you come from. Mm-hmm. And particularly how your early background led you into this life of academia that you've enjoyed so much.
Sure. So my father has been a college professor. I grew up in Lombard and went to the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, had a number of positions, and then began teaching at a small college, Coker College, in Hartsville, South Carolina. So my family moved there when I was three, and so that's where I grew up. He's had a long career there and retired. And I would say that growing up, I was certainly in a household where I was a child of two teachers. My mother was teaching piano. She was teaching organ lessons for a while. And in high school, I really enjoyed tutoring other people. I tutored some high school students. I tutored some college students in math. And that sort of put me on a trajectory of imagining that I would have a life of teaching. And when I got to Sewanee and majored in math and then majored in English as well, I did a lot of thinking about the institution I'd like to be a part of. I thought it would be delightful to be at a liberal arts college. In graduate school, that's how I started, wishing to be at a liberal arts college. Along the way, I will tell you that I thought about being a research mathematician, but then by the time I was finishing graduate school, I thought that I would prefer a liberal arts college. And so that really set the trajectory. Mm.
This is part of every biography of you that I have read, and not that you go out of your way to trumpet this fact, but people who write about you certainly like to trumpet the fact that you enrolled in Sewanee at the age of 15.
That's right. That is true.
You maybe are tired of answering questions about this, but I hope not too tired to answer this one at least. I am most curious about what that felt like to be a 15-year-old college freshman. And I'm curious especially what value that particular matter was. If you grew or gained certain life lessons by being, in a sense, someone, I should think, in some ways at least, set apart from the rest of your classmates.
It's probably good to approach this by describing what my high school experience was like, junior high and high school. I had been somewhat advanced in math, and then I was able to skip eighth grade and then take classes in high school in the order in which I wanted. This was a privilege I was given from the county administration. But what all this meant was that I took junior and senior level classes in high school, and I was known as that guy who skipped eighth grade. And frankly, I wasn't so socially capable. And so although intellectually it was fine, I enjoyed the classes, I enjoyed marching band, I enjoyed a number of things. It wasn't an environment where I was making a lot of friends and felt really comfortable. And so when I essentially run out of classes in high school, my family didn't really imagine that I could go to a boarding school or something like that. That didn't seem in the cards. And so I was going to need to go somewhere else. And I thought that this would be a delightful opportunity, frankly, to start over. And so certainly the admissions office at Sewanee knew that I was young, and they told the resident assistant or the hall director, but other people didn't know. And I didn't look obviously young. Many college students look young.
Right.
And it was a tremendous chance to be myself in a new way without the kind of baggage of the past. I made a lot of friends. It was a great start. And then 2 months in, I started to tell people. And then by then it was an amusing joke. I mean, yes, it was an item to talk about, but I had a social place, and that was very meaningful.
Right. So they got to know you before.
That's right.
They knew you were a boy genius of sorts. You also, I am intrigued to say, were a double major in mathematics and English.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people would be maybe astonished by that if one only thinks about kind of lazy generalities about what mathematicians are interested in, what English majors are interested in. They can sometimes seem like different planets.
Right.
So tell us about this dual interest, and if for you it felt like you had one foot on one planet and one foot on another, or did they feel like a very comfortable and natural combination?
I'd certainly appreciated math from a young age. So going to Sewanee, it wasn't, and I'd had some college classes before I started, so it wasn't really going to be a question of whether to finish a major in math. But Sewanee is also a very literary place, and my AP English teacher in high school was thrilling, frankly, and I loved talking about literature. And so I decided to major in English as well. There are certainly some interesting differences. People often think that math is about numbers, but I think a mathematician would tell you it's really about systems, systems of thinking. Literature is certainly about people and characters. But at another level, at the kind of analytical level, I would say that there are some striking similarities. In studying literature, there are often questions that are ambiguous or have ambiguous answers, and you need to think through some possibilities and think through what might be true about those characters and their relationship to each other. And in mathematics, it's not finally ambiguous once you finally understand everything. But along the way, it feels ambiguous. I'm sure lots of people have felt that way about math. And so it's that same process of exploration, of trying one thing, trying another, seeing whether it really quite fits. And so I would say that, you know, literary criticism and mathematical research are not that far apart in the analytical sense. Mm.
You went on to a long distinguished career teaching at Davidson College, which is someplace in North Carolina.
Yes.
And then the siren call came from your alma mater, Sewanee. Explain that moment in your career.
Sure. So I'd come back from my second sabbatical at Davidson, and I had started exploring having a bigger scope for the work I was doing. So I joined some large committees, strategic planning and otherwise, and started leading some of those committees and found it really quite rewarding to think together about the future of the institution. And then John McArdle, who was recently appointed at Sewanee as the new president, somehow got my name and called me up and said he wanted to talk about my coming as provost. So long story about the fact that I wasn't even sure what that meant, but I did go home and I talked to my family about it. I said, well, there's an opportunity. We can all go to Sewanee. And there was a resounding no. My children were 12 and 14, and they said, you know, we like where we are. There's no need to move. And Cameron, you know, certainly was of the same mind. And so I called him back up and I said, well, it's, you know, maybe I could do something for you in the summer or something, but this is just not the right chance for the family. And, you know, maybe some other time, but thank you. And John, being the creative person he is, came back with, well, let's think about this a bit. What if we set up a year trial where I don't have to commit any more than a year? You don't have to commit more than a year. Your family doesn't have to commit. Davidson would probably give you a leave. And then you could all explore. You could try it out, see what you think. So I went home and I pitched that. We had, because we had spent 2 years abroad, the idea of spending another year away, but then coming home was not foreign. And my older child, Ruth, said, well, of course we're coming back, and you're messing with my high school curriculum. And so I'm going to have to stay in the fall, take 2 extra classes, so that when we come home, I will still be back on track. And my younger child said, so I would enter a new school in the middle of the year? I'm not going to do that. So long story short, my younger child, Sophie, came with me at the beginning of the year. And so we have a very close, tremendously close relationship. She was 13 then. Mm. And Cameron and my older child, Ruth, came in January. And over the course of the year, we decided it was a good move for us. And so there was a lot of wisdom in John McArdle's offer. Yeah. And I'm glad we were open enough to new experiences to explore it.
Right. So you were provost there and you were something else, I think.
Yes, provost first and then executive vice president. John McArdle had wanted a chief operating officer, which, again, frankly, I didn't understand the meaning of at the beginning. But I learned quickly. he wanted someone to handle all internal operations of the campus so that he could really be away and think entirely strategically. He had a provost, and in fact, he had been a provost at Middlebury College, and so he understood that relationship. And so it worked very well between the two of us. He's certainly not a micromanager. We could discuss a few principles on issues, and then he just was happy to walk away and let things be handled.
Let you go. You were telling me before we went on the air that Sewanee, it's the University of the South.
That's right.
But called Sewanee kind of affectionately because of, in a sense, the community where it is located. You were telling me such a fascinating thing about that.
Yeah, so it is a community. That's probably the best word for it. It's not a municipality. There's not a formal town that would have been approved of or acknowledged by the state. In fact, Sewanee, the University of the South, is chartered in Tennessee as an institution of higher education that owns a fair amount of land. Now 13,000 contiguous acres, and essentially operates as the town. Now, it can't make laws, of course, but municipal services, police, fire, garbage, are all run by the university for residents. Residents can own houses, but not the land underneath them. And my role as the operating officer was in part to deal with these quasi-municipal issues, parks, police and fire. It's not that there were taxes, but there were fees. And I will say that having done that for a while, part of it was very rewarding, but at the same time, it makes a lot of sense to have a locally elected government handle all of that and not have an institution of higher education try to be a municipality.
Right, try to be the garbage company and the fire company and everything else. So when this offer came from Carthage College to be its president, you were being offered the opportunity to do something you had never done before. In other words, you have never been a college president before.
That's right.
I wonder what that leap represents for you. Maybe I shouldn't call it a leap. That makes it sound scary or scarier than it is. But nevertheless, a step into a position you have not ever held before. I wonder what that represented for you yourself, and also what was your sense from the search committee at Carthage. Although I have not heard the slightest word of hesitancy from anybody who was part of the search process about you, and yet I should think at one point or another that probably came up that there's one element where it feels a little like we're hiring a very promising rookie versus somebody who had already been maybe a president at a smaller institution or something. What do you think that matter of you being a first-time president has to do with this moment in your life?
In some ways, having been the chief operating officer, I think prepares one pretty well to know how the internal operations work, and that translates well from one institution to another. Another way I've thought about it, and I said this to the search committee, is that my primary role was operations, but that included strategy and also relationships, broadly conceived, faculty and staff, campus, community, and also relationships with donors and friends. And the transition from an operating officer to the presidency, for me, the way I think about it is it's, the presidency should be about strategy and relationships. There are a lot of relationships that are going to be the strongest only or the most with the president. There can certainly be other people on campus. So that is a very important role that the president plays. And then certainly working with the board on the strategy for the institution. And then other things that are really more operational should be delegated. And so, of course, coming as the operating officer, it may be tempting to do some more operational things that because I felt like I learned something along the way. But in some ways, it was a shift of emphasis. So I would say I was doing more operations and strategy and some relationships, and now I'll be doing strategy and relationships and less operations.
So it feels like a very natural progression for you professionally.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. John Swallow, who is the president of Carthage College. He just assumed that position on the 1st of July from his predecessor, Dr. Gregory Woodward. Dr. Swallow is the 23rd president in Carthage's 170-year history. So, President Swallow, you take the reins at Carthage at a point in time when, in at least in many, many respects, the school is as strong as it has ever been. I want to ask you a couple of questions about that, and it feels sort of like a weird deja vu because a couple of these questions are also questions I posed to President Woodward when he joined me for the last time in the middle of June. First of all, what would you identify as the most significant of Carthage's strengths at this point in time, or maybe distinctive strengths upon which you intend to really try to build an even richer future?
This may sound a little unusual because usually someone might say a facility or a program. But what I find quite distinctive about Carthage among liberal arts colleges is a sense and an experience with trying new things, facing some interesting and tough questions and addressing them well. And Carthage's move to Kenosha from Carthage, Illinois, crystallizes that for me. So it's an institution that has not thought that there was one period of time in the past that was somehow perfect that we need to get back to. But it's been a long series of challenges successfully met and initiatives undertaken that have brought it to where it is today, which has been a long period of growth and development and new facilities and programs. And it's that spirit, frankly, that I find distinctive. We will want, of course, to translate that distinction into a distinction that is felt by prospective students and families. But in my experience, many liberal arts colleges have a hard time doing anything different from each other. They have a hard time being bold. they look over their shoulder at each other and they sort of follow the herd. They don't want to get out too far. And in today's situation with higher education, I think distinction is going to matter more. I think we need to be able to say how Carthage is able to deliver liberal arts education in a way that is not the same as other institutions. And so it's drawing on that organizational culture and translating that into the external environment that, for me, 5 weeks in, admittedly, is a distinction that I'm really hoping to build on.
Hmm. One of the matters that was really on my mind when I spoke to Dr. Woodward in June, I think was partly because I'd been one of the people who served as a questioner for the transfer scholarships, which occurred in the middle of May. And one of the young people that I had the pleasure of interviewing during that day-long event was a young man who was at a small liberal arts school in the heart of Indiana, I believe, that was about to close.
Yes.
So they were going to close their doors at the end of that school year. And it was really something to sit across from this big, strapping baseball player and see a hint of tears in his eyes as he talked about this school that he loved so much that was about to close. And that, of course, necessitated him transferring someplace, perhaps Carthage. I just started thinking about what that would feel like to be part of a school, to be as a student or faculty or staff, that was suddenly going to, in a sense, wink out of existence. And that is not just limited to this particular school, but there are all kinds of small liberal arts schools, especially across the country, who are struggling for their very existence right now at a point in time when Carthage, at least in many respects, is flourishing.
That's right.
I wonder if you could speak to that sort of relatively grim landscape and help us understand why you think Carthage is one of those schools that is managing to succeed at a point in time when many other schools, at least roughly akin to it, are struggling terribly and in some cases even forced to close.
Sure. In some ways, this goes back to the decision, the wise decision that was made to move to Kenosha in the late 50s, early 60s, where Carthage College itself faced, I think, what a lot of institutions are facing now.
Yeah.
Now, the present moment is one where the number of high school graduates is either flat or declining, so there will be a lot more competition among liberal arts colleges and others for those students, and that's something that every institution has to respond to. But there's also a trend in the founding of so many liberal arts colleges. And again, I've come from one that was a part of this trend, founded in the 19th century in the wilderness. The idea being that it was important to be away from commerce and cities and temptations. and all of that was well at the time. But students today and their families would like to see lots of opportunities. Some of those recreational, of course, but some of those connected to internships, corporations, nonprofits, government, for the development of society itself. And Carthage is very well positioned. So not only is it strong financially, but it is so well positioned in communities that are collaborative and interested in partnering in ways that these other institutions, many of which are wonderful and fine, but they're simply in very small places.
Right.
And so their opportunities are simply going to be limited. Carthage faced that in a town in Illinois and made a decision it was time to move. And so that was prescient. So it was good for Carthage College at the time, and I think it will be particularly good for Carthage now.
Right. When we are speaking to, of course, my department at Carthage is music, and so when we are speaking to prospective students thinking about Carthage among other fine options, we often find ourselves preaching location, 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 and often they think it's because of that beautiful lake that we're positioned
right.
on. And, of course, we really in the next breath we try to clarify that the location that really matters is Milwaukee is right there and
yes.
Chicago is right there. And for that matter, Kenosha and Racine themselves
right.
offer all kinds of very interesting opportunities mm-hmm. and adventures. And so it's a great place for college to be located. I took you across the hall when you walked into the building today to show you the office of President Brian Albrecht,
yes.
your counterpart here at Gateway. And I know that you have met Chancellor Ford at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. I wonder if you could say a word, admittedly 5 weeks into the job, but your impressions of what at least strikes me as an exceptionally close and cordial relationship between these three institutions of higher learning that in another scenario might be sort of nasty competitors, but here work in such a cooperative spirit.
That's right. It wasn't but a few days after my arrival that I received the invitation to come to the every so often breakfast that the three presidents have at various locations around town. And so I attended my first, and Debbie and Brian were extremely welcoming, told me about initiatives that had taken place together and how they'd be happy to welcome me into this or that community and provide a heads up about something. And they both offered at any time that I could call upon them if I had questions. And that really reflected exactly what I think of you're saying, which is that Kenosha and Racine seem to be places, and again, I'm still learning, this 5 weeks in, where the various institutions do see themselves as coming together for the benefit and the development of the community. And that is a wonderful aspect. There are so many interested in Kenosha's continued development and in Racine's development as well. And these three institutions serve different purposes. There's some overlap. There's some articulation agreements, which is great for students to proceed from one to the other. But they're not fundamentally in competition with one another, and they can serve different roles in the community. And in fact, the three together can have a more amplified effect than the three individually.
Absolutely. And it's been exciting to see the ways in which that has borne wonderful fruit for, all three schools, which are all doing very, very well. We're speaking at a point in time when, at least more so than I can remember in my memory, the institutions of higher learning and the whole notion of being well-educated is, in a sense, under siege. We find ourselves more acutely aware of a fairly significant swath of the population, American population, that seems to view the world that you and I travel in with a great deal of suspicion. I wonder, first of all, how aware you have been of that, where you've been before Carthage, and also what you think those of us who are part of this world need to do about that. And is this a situation in which we have some culpability? I mean, have we done things or said things that have helped create this? Where does this sense of suspicion come from? And as I said, the real question is what do we do about that? How do we move forward from here?
In the last several years, higher education has come under more scrutiny than it has in some time, although I would say this is cyclical. The questions about the liberal arts, they're not new. people have asked questions about their practicality or their ability to prepare one for a lifetime of service and leadership. So we're coming around again. One aspect that's a bit different in the current media market is that there are fewer and fewer reporters with expertise in higher education as newspapers are cutting staffs. It used to be you might have a reporter that covered higher education solely. Mm-hmm. Now it might be one of 10 things the reporter covers. And so not all the stories are well thought through and accurate. But that's not a dodge. By mentioning the fact that there are fewer or flat high school students, it's a very natural question for institutions to ask. Are we providing an education for lifelong learning and service to the community in a way that is relevant and understood by prospective students and their families. I'm a firm believer that the liberal arts are really part of all the development of life, and I would think that where we can sometimes go wrong is drawing some artificial boundaries. That if something's on one side of the boundary, that it is education, and if it's on the other side of the boundary, well, it's entirely too technical, or it's too practical. I tend to believe that either ors are a mistake, and it can be a both and. And I think Carthage College has acknowledged that. It has a business program. It has a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, which are two programs that, to me, are firmly grounded in the liberal arts, yet have some technical aspects, just as many of the liberal arts disciplines do, such as mathematics, and are preparing students well for productive lives and careers. So that's my hope, is that we don't draw boundaries where we don't need to, that we can be open to doing many things well at the same time, and not trying to be standoffish, elite in a negative sense, but to be proud of the holistic and comprehensive education we offer, and to welcome many, many students to take part in that.
Mm-hmm. What about the question that also has arisen that is probably maybe somewhat related, but the question of a diversity of voices being welcome in institutions of higher learning, and the charge that comes from some that places like Carthage, but not specifically Carthage, are places that harbor certain ways of viewing the world, certain political perspectives or philosophical perspectives, to the detriment of other perspectives that sort of run contrary to it. First of all, do you think that's a valid concern? Is it worth thinking about and talking about? And what are your own personal priorities in terms of ensuring that places like Carthage are open in the best or healthiest sense of the word?
Right. Well, a diversity of experience, finally, is, I think, part an essential part of education. And so whether that might be spending some time abroad or taking classes in a variety of disciplines or hearing opinions that differ significantly from one's own, all of that seems to me part and parcel of growth and development intellectually and personally. And when it comes to the composition of the student body or faculty and staff, this is certainly an important aspect. If everyone around you seems just like you, then probably you've missed an opportunity in these formative years to think about how you might be different, or the fact simply that other people are different, sometimes in perfectly acceptable and ways that we would want to celebrate. So students come from different high schools with different characteristics, and I think the best liberal arts colleges can shape classes that provide good and diverse experiences for many people. At the same time, I think the approach in the past has been to, and this is where the mathematician in me thinks that things are not approached well. It's not simply a matter of looking at percentages of students or faculty or staff from different groups. That is reducing it to a number. And what we're talking about is people and relationships. You can certainly have more or fewer people from, you know, this or that group, and that doesn't mean that people are interacting any better or understanding each other any better. And so that's where I've seen a lot of value in the word inclusion, by which we mean are people truly understanding other points of view, other backgrounds, financially and otherwise, geographically, country of origin, and paying particular attention to whether the discussions that are occurring in the classroom and in the residence hall are really reflecting that, or are frankly just as segregated as they had been, but there are just different, you know, just different compositional diversity in the student body. So there's a lot of work to do there. This is, you know, frankly, work that all of us should be doing all the time. I consider myself someone open to new experiences. This by no means is to suggest that I've come any further than others. But I find this kind of interchange exciting because I think it's part of my own growth. And I would hope that that's the same kind of spirit we can inculcate in our students.
I just interviewed recently a professor from Yale who said something to that effect in a new book of his, in which he essentially said, I think one of the most valuable lessons a person can learn is that they have something to learn from somebody who sees the world differently than they do.
Yes.
Even if you are not going to end up seeing the world the way they do, but just learning from these perspectives that maybe rub against your own. I for one, realize that it's very tempting to kind of insulate yourself amidst people who see the world exactly as you do. There's comfort in that, but you are robbing yourself of something very rich.
That's right. And understanding the world we live in. That's right.
In the last few minutes of our conversation, and the time has flown, I wonder if you could just say a word about anything specific, although perhaps it's way too early to be talking in specifics, but in terms of areas of vision that you have for Carthage and its future at this point in time?
Sure. What I will say is really in response to what I've heard from campus and community leaders across the board, which is this willingness, which I find remarkable, for Carthage to partner with institutions and groups and organizations in Kenosha, Racine, and beyond. I met with the superintendents of the Kenosha and Racine school districts, and I've met with the Kenosha police chief and the fire chief. I met with the mayor and the county executive, and to a person, people say that they're delighted that Carthage is here, and they would like to see what Carthage can do for the development of the community. And I'd like to really keep posing that question at a large level. On one hand, yes, we are preparing students. That is what we do. We prepare students to enter communities here and elsewhere, equipped and qualified to develop society and to contribute to its development. But we might ask more than that. We might ask, how do our students and faculty and staff contribute to the development of the region before students graduate, along the way? Is that part of education itself? Is that you just mentioned how we're all developing? Is that a way that all of us on campus may develop and see our success as connected to the development of the region? So where that leads, I don't know. What it will mean, I can't say. But it's the kind of question that I think responds well to the interest in the community to collaborate.
Last quick question about your predecessor, Dr. Gregory Woodward. I don't think he had much direct presence in the search process. I think typically that's the way that's done. But I'm sure you have had some contact with him. Can you just tell us the difference that he has made in this period of transition and the kind of things he shared with you in terms of what Carthage is and what its potential is in the future?
Sure. Well, I can tell you that Greg Woodward is a big believer in Carthage College, and it's not only his personal investment, but he thinks it's a fabulous institution. And during his time here, he's diversified the student body. This was a significant objective of his. So the level of diversity has risen from under 20% to almost 30% in a relatively short amount of time, and he's really quite proud of that, and I think the college is quite proud of that. He's also started some programs in an entrepreneurial sense. The nursing program started just a couple of years ago, and he's relying on that spirit I mentioned earlier of being able to take on some questions and address them well. So those are the things that he told me that he was proud of. He's proud of kind of keeping that spirit going, imagining, and the recent strategic plan certainly bears this out, lots of ideas for development. Not all of them are going to be exactly the right ones. We have to pick and choose along the way. But keeping that moving and setting Carthage's sights high. So he did. We've had several conversations by phone. He's been a real resource. And also I've had the privilege to sit down with Greg and Barbara Campbell at their house here and hear from them about their long history with Carthage as well. And so it's really helping me complete the picture.
Right. Well, your first name might not be Greg.
Thankfully.
Yeah, that would be nice and confusing. But in every other respect, this seems like it makes all the sense in the world for you to be the new president of Carthage College. And I should add on a personal note that I have a niece who is about to begin her education at Carthage this fall.
Great. So can't wait to meet her.
I feel good about both of those developments very much, her coming to Carthage and yours as well. Dr. John Swallow, the new president of Carthage College, it's been such a pleasure to meet you, and I hope we will be able to have many such conversations as in the ensuing years, and we certainly wish you well, you and your family, and this new chapter in your life.
Thank you, Greg. It's been great to be with you.
Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College. Tomorrow on the morning show, Gwida Brown will join us. She is the director of the Hope Council for Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse, and we will talk about the important work that the Hope Council does and also talk about what has been called an epidemic, the opioid epidemic that has wreaked such havoc across the country in communities of every size, and it's certainly a vexing challenge that we will explore tomorrow. On Monday, you'll hear from the directors of a powerful documentary called Two Towns of Jasper, This documentary first aired in 2003. It is re-airing next week on PBS. It centers on a heartbreaking case of a hate crime in Jasper, Texas, and of some of the lessons that were learned in the wake of that crime. And these two directors, one black, one white, went into Jasper with separate film crews, one black, one white, talking to the citizens of Jasper, Texas. The film that they developed is absolutely fascinating. And you'll hear my conversation with the co-directors, co-producers.